this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the headline for the cover story, The State Escape. Will the last agency leaving a state office building in downtown Raleigh please turn out the lights? And that headline is superimposed over a picture of a ceiling with a light bulb on. That takes up most of the front page. And the article actually begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with the headline, Several State Agencies Mull Move Outside of Downtown Raleigh. Crumbling buildings, unsafe conditions, and lack of space among reasons for exit. And this article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with a Dateline of Raleigh. Repairs to the worn-out carpets and dinged-up walls in North Carolina's aging state government buildings in downtown Raleigh will have to wait. The state has more pressing building issues right now. Failing HVAC systems, faulty fire alarms, water seepage, and asbestos are threatening the safety and security of nearly 10,000 state government workers and contractors who commute into downtown Raleigh each day. Some buildings are in such poor shape that state agencies have started looking for leased office space instead. According to a recent state construction office report, North Carolina is facing more than $3.9 billion in building deficiencies statewide due to deferred maintenance and repair issues, much of that among the state government's downtown complex in the capital city. We are at a critical point, says Spiros Phlegas, Deputy Secretary for the North Carolina Department of Administration, the department that serves as business manager and landlord for North Carolina state government. Phlegas says his office cheered last year when Governor Pat McCrory allocated $150 million in his budget for repairs and renovations to the state's $25.6 billion inventory of state and university buildings. But it doesn't come close to covering all the needs, he says. Only $90 million of that $150 million went to the buildings that are not on university campuses, and even that money had to be spread around to dozens of state-owned properties across the state. Most of the money is now filtering to the construction contractors, architects, engineers, and suppliers for repairs that won't even be that noticeable to the public, such as new joint sealants, crack repair, and waterproofing at a parking deck on Salisbury Street that will cost about $1.6 million. The fire alarm system at the North Carolina Museum of History that is obsolete and needs to be replaced at a cost of $538,000. About 19,000 fluorescent light fixtures in the downtown government complex that are no longer being manufactured and will cost about $100 each to replace. For about 80 workers at the State Bureau of Investigation complex on Garner Road, it's been too little, too late. At the Council of States meeting in February, members approved the SBI's request to move its unit that processes fingerprints and criminal background checks to lease space in a privately owned office building on Falls of Neuse Road in North Raleigh. The SBI's Criminal Information and Identification Section had been working from a building constructed in 1931 that was in serious need of renovation and deemed unsuitable for office use. Preliminary assessments of the SBI building found extensive asbestos and lead-based paint, two common building materials used prior to the mid-1970s and now considered a health hazard, as well as major plumbing, electrical, and mechanical system problems. Phlegas says his office does the best it can with the resources it is allocated, but a conventional maintenance and repair budget should range from 2 to 4% of a building's value each year, just to make sure the buildings neither decline nor improve. For North Carolina's $25.6 billion building inventory, that would amount to between $512 million and $1 billion per year in maintenance and repair costs. A traditional office building would also undergo a minor renovation at least once every 20 years and undergo a major renovation once every 40 years. The last major renovation of any building in the downtown government complex was in the mid-1990s when the old education building on Edenton Street was gutted and fully refurbished. The high-rise Archdale building on Salisbury Street, home to the North Carolina Department of Environment and Natural Resources, was slated for a major renovation upon completion of Diener's Green Square office building in 2012. But Flega says the department ran out of money before renovations could start. We had the plans already done to renovate those floors, and it's still a possibility, but now it'll be more inconvenient because people will have to be relocated temporarily again, he says. Still, the $150 million budgeted in 2014 is more money than the state legislature has allocated in 1 year to building repairs and renovations than in any year of the past decade. The North Carolina legislature funded an average $65.7 million to repairs and renovations between 2000 and 2010, according to State Senator Neil Hunter of Raleigh. The state has funded an average of $74.4 million per year between 2011 to 2014. We are looking for more funding for the 2014 to 2015 fiscal year, Hunt says. State lawmakers are just now starting to put together their budget plans and requests for 2014 to 2015 fiscal year, and priorities for teacher pay raises and regulation reform have generated the most public attention, overshadowing any discussion about crumbling state buildings. Until we have a better idea of our revenue picture, we won't know how much we have to dedicate to this issue, but we acknowledge it's a priority to our agencies, according to a statement from House Speaker Tom Tillis's office. A solution? One funding possibility that lobbyists for the construction industry are pointing to is the additional debt capacity that could be available this year for capital projects. According to the Treasurer's 2014 Debt Affordability Study, the state's general fund will have an additional debt capacity of $570 million for each of the next 10 years. While Treasurer Janet Cowell encouraged state leaders to protect the state's AAA bond rating and restrict financial arrangements for debt or debt-like obligations, she noted in her report that the debt capacity this year is an improvement from previous years. The needs speak for themselves, says Dave Simpson, Carolina AGC's North Carolina Government Relations and Building Director. The Treasurer's report is something I hope the legislature will look at to help replace some buildings that are no longer safe for state employees. And there's a related article headlined, "For some agencies, it's a race for bigger space." And this article is also written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the Dateline of Raleigh. With no new plans in the pipeline to add or expand state government buildings in the capital city, North Carolina state agencies have run out of office options for consolidation and growth. But that is opening up new opportunities for Triangle area landlords seeking tenants for empty area office buildings. In the past 3 months, three sizable office lease requests have been issued by the State Property Office, seeking options for a combined 330,000 square feet of office space on behalf of three agencies, the Department of State Treasurer, the Department of Public Safety, and the Department of Health and Human Services. While each agency has its own special needs and requirements, each is trying to consolidate staff onto fewer campuses in order to improve efficiencies. Right now, it's a matter of finding the right fit for the right agency, says Chris Mears, a spokesman for the State Property Office. The amount of office space that North Carolina government workers occupy has been steadily increasing through the years. In 1995, about 21% of the space that state agencies occupied in Wake County was in lease space on private properties. By 2008, when the state's government facilities master plan was updated, that percentage had grown to 26% and an estimated $23 million per year in rental expense. Drew Harbinson, Director of Procurement and Logistics for the Department of Public Safety, says his agency would prefer to have all of its staff in a state-owned building and not scattered at properties all across Raleigh. But there's no money to build at this time, and we need the space, he says. In January, DPS issued a request for 140,000 square feet of office space in Raleigh after its long-term lease at a building on Yonkers Road in Raleigh expired. The EPS has the option of renewing its lease at Yonkers Road, where about 500 people on its staff are based. But the state will also be looking at other proposals that were submitted by the February 11 deadline. DHHS last fall pored through five different office building proposals before deciding to consolidate its NCFAST case management program and other DHHS benefit enrollment staff into one building at the Research Commons Office Park in Research Triangle Park. That deal will relocate about 500 DHHS employees from other Raleigh buildings and will cost the state $2.2 million a year in rental fees. The state treasurer's office proposal, however, will probably cause the most disruption to the downtown government complex and probably fetch the highest rental value. The treasurer's office currently leases space in both the state-owned Albemarle and Seaboard office buildings and in three other private office buildings in other parts of Raleigh. The goal with this proposal, says treasurer spokesman Shore Johnson, is to bring all 420 state treasurer staff members under one roof. Two of our leases are expiring this summer, so it made sense to look at this option now, he says. The state property office told us there was no space available for all 420 people in a state building, so we're looking at other options. The department received 9 bid options for the proposal, but the location decision hasn't been finalized. Mike Green, broker in charge of the BPG management company in Raleigh, was one of the bidders for the public safety lease proposal, offering up a deal for DPS to backfill office space on Capitol Boulevard in Raleigh that another state agency vacated a year ago. We have a long history with the state, and they've always been an excellent tenant for us, Green says. John Carr with York Properties says he also submitted the Yonkers Road facility for lease renewal for the DPS deal. They can have some peculiarities on how they pay for space, but if you have a building with that much space, you'd be foolish to not at least take a look at it, he says. It's a credit tenant, and state government is a big part of Raleigh. And we have one other article on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. This article is headlined, Doors Open at BDSI with $60 Million Boost. And this article is written by Jason DeBrun with the Dateline of Raleigh. Mark Sergo uses the word transformational a lot these days. With good reason, he argues. After all, the company he leads, BioDelivery Sciences International, just raised $60 million, expects approval from the FDA on a new drug, and has seen its market cap jump to record levels in recent weeks. I know we've been saying it a lot lately, but we really think this is a transformational time for our company, Sergo says. Headquartered on Corporate Center Drive in an office park near PNC Arena, Sergo expects BioDelivery Sciences to do something this year that few small drug development companies achieve. Commercialize a drug it fully developed without licensing any portion of that drug to Big Pharma. Make no mistake, BioDelivery is, by every essential measure, a small company. It employs 25 workers, generates more expenses from research and development than revenue, and has a stock that trades at less than $9 per share. Typically, a company of this size would look to a larger drug company with the capital and market presence to effectively commercialize a new drug. Indeed, David Ridley with Duke University's Business School says that while a small company going it alone in this way is not unique, it is certainly unusual. The benefits, however, are obvious. Forming a partnership with a larger company would give BioDelivery access to a more established brand name, but it would license away a potentially substantial portion of revenue. Going it alone means BDSI will keep ownership of the drug, which is called Bunavail, spelled B-U-N-A-V-A-I-L, and would treat opioid dependence, a market in the $1.5 billion range. This keeps incentives balanced in BioDelivery's favor, says Ridley. If sales reps from a large drug company have two similar drugs to market, and one of those is shared with a small company like BDSI, reps could see more incentive to sell the drug that isn't shared because they would potentially make more money. With BioDelivery likely hiring a contract sales force, however, the sales reps have an equal incentive to sell Bunavail. This strategy isn't without challenges. It's difficult, maybe even impossible, to build a sales force from scratch, Ridley says. Doctors can be wary of sales reps, and the real challenge is that you want a sales rep who has the trust and the ear of a doctor in your specialty area, Ridley says. Because BioDelivery would market to a very targeted specialty market, contracting with a quality sales force might be easier than if they were trying to sell something like a diabetes or cholesterol drug, for example. On the plus side, BioDelivery spokesman Al Medwar says 90% of all subscriptions for opioid dependents are made by 5,000 doctors, so a giant sales force wouldn't be necessary. Still, BDSI has never commercialized a product on its own, so this would be uncharted territory for the company. To that end, Surgo hired David Akison as Vice President of Sales and Managed Markets in December to head commercialization efforts. Of course, a $60 million cash infusion from institutional investors never hurts. When news broke that BioDelivery raised the money in a round led by Federated Kaufmann, it sent the stock price up 12%. Clearly, investors saw the move as a positive step, though at a single-digit share price, Wall Street is still holding off on anointing BioDelivery as a prince in drug development. And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to the Biz column, a quick glance at Triangle happenings. And the headline that starts it off, Ethics Bowl students meet local leaders. For the second year in a row, Biz was part of the North Carolina Independent Colleges and Universities-sponsored Ethics Bowl, and as usual, the entire program hit all the right notes. What was interesting for Biz was just how many of our business and community leaders were willing to share their weekend with the students from about 20 colleges and their administrators. From State Representative Rick Glazier of Fayetteville to Leslie Hayes of Wells Fargo's Triad Operations, about 45 professionals across the state were part of this year's contest that focused on ethics in healthcare. Some of the other judges and moderators present at the event were Holly Wanger with Duke Energy, Leslie Walden from Fidelity Investments RTP Operations, and Mary Rose Steigerwald, president of Raleigh-based Ellenvar. Bob Ingram, the former CEO of GlaxoSmithKline, spoke to the students during the weekend festivities. And for the record, Wake Forest University won the Ethics Bowl this year. When in France, drink and buy French wines. Biz caught up with Craig Heffley, owner of Durham-based Wine Authorities, who recently opened a second shop in Raleigh. He's just returned from a trip to France to visit producers and check out the latest trends. What's trendy there is a new thing I'm not as excited about. A natural wine movement, Heffley says. The focus is to make wine using only grapes and yeast, which is what most people think wine is. It tends to get re-fermented and be spritzy and can get a bacteria that makes it smell like a barnyard. A lot of them are awful. They taste cidery and get away from what wine is. Heffley works only with small wine producers, which means a much more personal experience when he travels to France. I have about 40 producers, and I stay in their homes and know their children's names, he says. They want to know about other farmers and ask my opinion on how their labels look and their price, what's similar. I'm their window to the world. The best part of the trip for the rest of us? Heffley brought back 9 new French wines. Pre-gala reception attracts local musical talent. Local musicians need to stick together, right? Biz saw that firsthand at the home of philanthropist and wine connoisseur Eliza Kraft Olander. The occasion was a private wine party hosted each year prior to the Triangle Wine Experience Gala, which raises money for the Frankie Lemon School. About 150 winemakers, distributors, sponsors, and friends gathered around Olander's home, drinking fine wines from her expansive collection. At one point in the evening, a man sat down at a baby grand piano and started playing tunes. Standing at the end of the piano enjoying the ivory pounding were local musicians Kat Robichaud and Joe Kwan. Robichaud was a contestant in this past season's reality show, The Voice, with recording artist CeeLo Green as her coach. Kwan is the cellist of popular North Carolina group, the Avett Brothers. And finally, funny, but it's still rock and roll to me. The piano man himself made a big impact on Raleigh over this past weekend. Billy Joel, who was in town for a sold-out performance at PNC Arena on February 9, was seen the night before at Bida Manda, a Laotian restaurant in downtown Raleigh. Joel, impressed with the pork belly soup, invited co-owner Vansana Nolintha and some of his staff to be his guests at the concert. The night of the event, Biz spotted Ruckus Pizza owner Robert Royster, Triangle Community Foundation's president Lori O'Keefe, and Mr. Time Warner Cable coach himself, Bill Cower, near the front of the stage. Joel entertained the packed house as he made small jabs about his ex-wife, Christie Brinkley, and played a handful of his more obscure songs, along with hits such as Pressure, Uptown Girl, You Might Be Right, and Piano Man, which had the entire audience singing along. In honor of the Beatles' 50th anniversary, Billy also performed Can't Buy Me Love and She Loves You. And along with this article, there is a picture of the set list from the concert. It's headlined Raleigh, North Carolina, February 9, 2014. And the song list is Miami 2017, Pressure, Fantasy, Can't Buy Me Love, Summer Highland Falls, Zanzibar, Where's the Orchestra, Allentown, Room of Our Own, Uptown Girl, Moving Out, Always a Woman, The Entertainer, Don't Ask Me Why, River of Dreams, Italian, Piano Man, and then after a break, Fire, Still Rock and Roll, She Loves You, You May Be Right, and Only the Good. Now returning to the full-length articles in the Triangle Business Journal, the headline, Why This Tech Startup Needs 10,000 Bottles of Wine. And this article is written by Lauren K. Onsorge with the Dateline of Wilmington. Tech startup Next Glass has a problem, too much wine. It's a real problem, CEO Kurt Taylor says. We've been purchasing wine left and right. Next Glass is in the process of creating what Taylor likes to call DNA profiles for hundreds of wines and beers, and it only requires about 10 milliliters. On-staff chemists test that wine dropper for 22,000 possible elements. The elements cover everything from texture to taste and are the big drivers behind its wine recommendation technology. But after the 10 milliliters are tested, we can't give it away fast enough, he says. A warehouse full of PVC pipe cut in honeycomb formations to store the bottles has already been filled. He estimates his team is housing 10,000 wines and 2,000 beers. Taylor says he's working too hard to drink any of it. His team selects one of each bottle and stacks them in the shopping carts, primarily at Harris Teeter stores, checking them out in the grocery line. We're in a real crunch to get all this data processed, so we've been buying all the beer and wine ourselves, he says. Eventually, he'll offer testing devices that wineries and breweries can use to upload themselves to the Next Glass system. The application hits in April, and there are a lot of bottles between now and then. We go through about 100 to 150 bottles a day, and we don't have that many friends, Taylor says. The team was trying to figure out a way to give it away at charity events, but our lawyers didn't want us to take on the liability, he says. But with each day of testing, Taylor gets to see his technology working. I have a couple of wines that I enjoy that are more than I want to spend, he says. It was neat that we were able to find a couple that have very similar taste profiles that are $10 to $15. And that's part of the goal, to make the wine selection easier for consumers. We thought there was a big opportunity to apply big data to create some objective recommendations to help people through that process, he says. When we started to explore how we could do it, we kind of came across the science behind the wine. Chemists use mass spectrometers to look at every compound in the wine, but all you have to do is use an easy app. It's free to consumers, he says. And money is made when businesses sign up to have access to the analytics. They have inventory selection tools that can help them optimize their inventory or wine list, he says. The company, which just named former Harris Teeter CEO Thomas Dixon to its board, is based in Wilmington and won top honors at the North Carolina Technology Association Awards last year. And now we turn to the reporter pages. The first one we come to is the page for Amanda Hoyle. Hoyle covers commercial and residential real estate. And in her retail news section, the headline is One-Stop Shop for Two Kinds of Brew. Raleigh Shop will feature locally sourced coffee, beer. A new independent coffee shop is coming to 111 Seaboard on P Street in downtown Raleigh. Coffee aficionados and partners A.J. Viola and Mike Scholar have signed a lease to open Brew in the 111 Seaboard building in late spring. Brew is a store concept that the friends have been working on for several months. Viola will be running the store. Scholar is a network engineer at Citrix. According to Viola, it's a store concept that they would also like to expand beyond coffee brewing and will also include beer brewed on draft and in bottles. They will be sourcing most of their coffee from Raleigh Coffee Company and other local coffee roasters, and most of the beer will come from local beer breweries, he says. At Seaboard, the owners lease the space between the Bad Daddy's Burger Bar Restaurant and the Sola Salon Hair Salon, according to Henry Ward with York Properties. John Kuntz of York brokered the deal. Brew will be the second independent coffee shop to open in downtown Raleigh in recent months. Local coffee roaster Matt Cady opened Café de los Muertos on the ground floor of the Hue building on Harget Street in January. And in the Deal Wire section, Skanska, Clancy and Thays chosen for new Union Station project. The construction team chosen to build the first phase of the Raleigh Union Station project is a joint venture between Raleigh-based Clancy and Thays and Skanska USA. The team will serve as the construction manager at risk, which means its members will be involved in the design process and must stick to a maximum bid price for the project. The total project cost for this first phase is estimated at $73 million. It includes the relocation of passenger rail service from the existing Amtrak station on Cabarrus Street to the Dillon Supply Warehouse building at 510 West Martin Street, also known as the Viaduct Building. Burt's Bees warehouse near RDU sells for $27 million. The massive 900 Aviation Warehouse building in Morrisville, the largest in Wake County, has been sold to a new investor group from Los Angeles for $26.85 million. A real estate fund affiliated with Ares Management in Los Angeles bought the 580,000-square-foot building from the Chicago real estate firm Pearlmark Real Estate Partners. The Burt's Bees Skin Care Products Company occupies more than half of the warehouse space. Other tenants include Home Comfort Furniture, Recall Total Information Management, and McAllister's Transportation Group. Builders chosen for renovation of UNC Chapel Hill Music Hall. UNC Chapel Hill has chosen Barnhill Contracting Company's Raleigh Building Division to lead the $15 million two-year renovation of the historic Hill Hall Music Auditorium. The work will include improvements to the rotunda and 550-seat auditorium, including adding an air conditioning system to the building. The building dates back to 1907 when it opened as the campus's first library. Work is expected to begin in early 2015. And finally, in the What's Going Up section, the tower crane at the site of the future Hilton Garden Inn Hotel near Crabtree Valley Mall has been moved into place, signaling the serious start of construction of the seven-story building. The 149-room hotel is slated to open in summer 2015 next to the Hampton Inn and Suites Hotel that opened in early 2013. Both buildings are atop the hill on Arrow Drive overlooking Glenwood Avenue and the I-440 Beltline. Amit Patel, president of Wynwood Hospitality Group in Morrisville that owns both hotel sites, says the $23 million Hilton Garden Inn project will add to the site the convenience of a sit-down restaurant, bar, and a 6,500-square-foot ballroom for social and corporate events. And now we have the reporter page for Lauren Onsorge. Onsorge covers infotech and entrepreneurism. And her first section is technology. The headline, Geolis, raising $2 billion is no problem. RTP's big expansion plan will require major private investment funds. Research Triangle Foundation CEO Bob Geolis is ever bullish about his plan to expand Research Triangle Park by 100 urban acres along I-40. And he says he knows how he'll pay for it. By talking to people like you. Geolis says public support for the project, estimated to cost more than $2 billion in private investment, has been overwhelming. Case in point, the day he made the announcement, he received 200 emails on his lunch break, and it hasn't subsided. I'm getting $125 an hour, he says. And it's exactly that level of support that has him smirking when I ask whether he's worried about raising the cash. After what I'm hearing, I do not expect it to be a problem, he says. He considers the news that RTF had fronted $17 million for the I-40 corridor to be taking the leadership in that funding effort. He says once the site plan is finalized, which could happen in the next several weeks, the checks will start coming in. And the next headline, Wanted, tech talent. Firms seek to balance rapid growth with maintaining company culture. Triangle tech firms are pushing out bullish projections when it comes to new hires in 2014, particularly emerging companies who are just starting to transition between a startup and a full-fledged company. Take NetCertive, a Morrisville marketing technology firm whose CEO, Brendan Morrissey, tells me will grow by up to 70 heads this year. We have stayed on the same rocket trajectory that we've been on since we did our Series A round, which is now just over 3 years ago, he says. We are literally hiring every week. I think we hired a half a dozen people in January. Of the current headcount of 130, about 70 were hired in 2013. But with the aggressive growth, how does Morrissey keep company culture in check? It's something that's admittedly hard to do, he says. We think of culture in the same vein that we think about excellence or client satisfaction. It's something that, if you stop working on it, you can't achieve it. Morrissey tries to stay one step ahead with vigorous orientation activities and regular team-building exercises. And every week, the entire NetCertive employee roster meets. It's really all about communication and inclusion, he says. Joe Colopy, CEO of Durham-based Bronto Software, might agree. Culture is a big part of the conversation when he makes hiring decisions. And he, too, will be making a lot of those in 2014 as his email marketing firm plans to expand by about 65 people in 2014. Our revenue now exceeds $30 million annually, and we need more people, especially in sales and engineering, to keep growing at a nice clip, he says. But it's not always easy to grow. Morrisville-based Automated Insights, a firm whose technology can write hundreds of stories in minutes, could be growing a lot faster than its 25-person headcount would imply. The problem is there's a specific skill set that we're looking for, CEO Robbie Allen says, and finding highly technical people in the job pool isn't easy. That's why he's resorted to bribery, a $5,000 reward to anyone who recommends a successful hire. And there's another section called Startup Scoop. The first headline here, Rums to be running in Raleigh. Chris Mendler is a Red Hatter, a father, a home brewer, and if the entrepreneurial stars line up, he'll be Raleigh's first legal rum maker. I've always wanted to do it, he says. It refers to starting his own brewing operation. In this case, the still-in-development Raleigh Rum Company. Mendler, a self-described nerd and dark beer connoisseur, works by day in IT at Red Hat, keyboard at the ready. But by night, he's a concoctor, creating craft infusions with friends and sharing the spoils. We always talked about a brewery as a pipe dream, he says. As laws changed and more North Carolina moonshine hit ABC store shelves, that pipe dream shifted from a mug to a shot glass. We realized a distillery would be something that's fun to pursue, something that we would be good at, he says. The challenge? Legally, we're not allowed to, without property permits, he says, meaning that, on the record, he's never brewed rum before. Yet he and two friends are funneling in their savings and launching a Kickstarter campaign to start a business based on doing just that. But he doesn't see the rum-making process as the biggest challenge. The process for making rum is actually relatively simple, especially when compared to brewery operations, and that's why we're going all in on this, he says. Distilling is kind of a simple science to begin with, and in a scientific nerdy mind, it translates well. You're basically making a brew and distilling it, boiling it down, catching those vapors, condensing them, making them into liquor. The biggest challenge is raising the money. A Kickstarter page aimed to fund the effort was about halfway toward a $14,781 goal as of February 10. The cash will go toward purchasing the equipment and renting a space, something that has to happen before the company can even get a permit to make the liquor. His goal? To have his operation up and running in downtown Raleigh by the end of 2014. And the next headline? American Underground preps for official opening of Raleigh Outpost. Life at American Underground these days? It's nuts. I don't know how else to describe it, says Adam Klein, chief strategy officer at the Durham-based Entrepreneurship Network. While running an organization that houses more than 120 startups is always hectic, the week of February 10 gets a burst of added nuts as American Underground, owned by Raleigh-based Capital Broadcasting, is prepping to open its Raleigh outpost to the public. Startups started moving in just before Christmas, with even more teams moving in the week of February 3. The big party happens next week with more than 200 VIPs registered to attend the February 19 event. Klein confirmed some big names on the RSVP list, including two from Google, Mary Grove, Director of Global Entrepreneurship Outreach, and Bridget Beam, Global Entrepreneurship Manager. He says the plan is still to expand outside the triangle. So far, American Underground has entrepreneurial hubs at American Tobacco Campus and Main Street in Durham, as well as the new space above Foundations Bar in Raleigh. And that's the focus right now, he says. We're considering different options, he says. We are excited about what's happening in the region to date and what's on the horizon. So for now, we're going to continue growing in Durham, he says. But if recent history is any indication, expect more hubs in downtown areas. We really, really like the idea of putting startups in prime downtown locations, he says. We want our startups to be at the center of the action. And the goal is to add 5 to 10 companies per month into American Underground space. And the final section is the He Said It section. The first quote, "We are actively recruiting, and our initial effort has led to several good resumes from in and around the region. We expect to actively hire through the rest of the year." That's Amit Shankar, head of ValueServe's Raleigh operations, offering an update on the more than 400 jobs his firm is bringing to the Triangle. And the next quote, "The thesis of our IPO was investing in sales and marketing, and that's what we've been doing." And that was Scott Wingo, CEO of Morrisville-based Channel Advisor, an e-commerce technology company that went public in 2013, speaking after announcing a 26% jump in fourth quarter revenue. And the next reporter page is that of Jason DeBrun. DeBrun covers healthcare and higher education. And his first section is a hot topic section. The headline, "Teacher Turnover, a Big Issue for North Carolina." The big talker this week circled around public education, particularly as an economic development tool, and how North Carolina must improve public education in order to create a better workforce in the future. The subject has been gaining steam since last year when the Republican-led legislature passed a budget that did not give teachers a pay increase. Teacher pay in North Carolina has been essentially frozen for 5 years, with the exception of a 1% increase just once in that time frame. Business organizations, including the North Carolina Chamber of Commerce and Best NC, a group of more than 60 C-suite executives, are advocating for higher teacher pay, particularly as they say the North Carolina workforce will suffer otherwise. They argue that better teachers will produce better students, but that the low pay compared to other states is causing the best teachers from this state to seek employment elsewhere. Indeed, North Carolina has a high turnover rate among teachers. In the last year, this state saw a 14.3% turnover rate, increasing from 12.1% the year before. The state's schools must recruit more than 11,000 new teachers each year because of turnover and population growth. Governor Pat McCrory made the announcement to increase starting teacher pay from $30,800 to $35,000. Under the new plan, teachers would receive the $35,000 starting salary for each of the first 9 years they teach. Compared with the current salary schedule, that would amount to an additional $34,830 in those 9 years. And now we have the page for Don Curry. Curry covers money and small business. And her article is headlined, Climate Hub, the 411 for Farmers. The Climate Change Research Hub being planted at NC State University's Centennial Campus will serve as a one-stop shop for farmers in the southeast region of the country. While the North Carolina Cooperative Extension and other groups offer a variety of education and research for the state's farmers and producers, the Climate Hub will funnel the information through one place, says David Marshall, research leader and location leader for the USDA Agricultural Research Service in Raleigh. Right now, we have 5 or 6 or 7 different types of entities with that kind of information, and they may have their own agendas, says Marshall. There's no aim to replace the corporate extension, the cooperative extension. We would more or less be using the entire resources of the federal government, he says. But that's not to say farmers in the rural South will take kindly to the federal government making recommendations as to how they should manage their land. It's not the intent of this to tell farmers or producers how they should be doing it, he says. They can tap into that info to see if it applies to them. This could be a one-stop shop. The Climate Hub, one of 7 in the nation, is still in the planning stages, and no price has been set for the project. And now we turn to the executive voice section. And in this edition of the Triangle Business Journal, the interview is with Greg Sandruder. The headline, Million Dollar Man with a One-Man Shop. And this article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle. At the early December groundbreaking ceremony for the new Sky House apartment tower in downtown Raleigh, Cary real estate developer Greg Sandruder was invited to the podium to say a few words after each of the other development partners had their chance to praise the 23-story building project. Sandruder, clearly out of his comfort zone, said a quick blessing for the food they were about to eat, Clyde Cooper's Barbecue, thanked his partners in the project, and sat down. The brevity of his comments caught some off guard, but it wasn't atypical for Sandruder, who prefers to be the one taking care of the details instead of taking credit for the deal. Since he arrived in the Triangle in 1988, fresh out of Harvard Business School, Sandruder has quietly become one of the more prolific commercial developers in the region. Among his more well-known projects, he helped build the RDU Center office park in Mooresville, redevelop Powerhouse Square with Progress Energy in downtown Raleigh, and develop both the Dawson and West condominium buildings in downtown Raleigh. He's currently working on his long-term goals for Edison, a nearly block-wide project in downtown Raleigh that will add a mid-rise apartment building and a 16-story office building next to Sky House. Yet Sandruder still has no local employees. In 2012, Sandruder merged his company, Hamilton Merritt, with his friend Peter Lash's company, Beacon Partners of Charlotte, to form one entity, since they were already partners on several deals. But in Raleigh, Sandruder still runs a one-man shop, working mostly from home and a local coffee shop. How do you do it? For many years, I was a virtual developer for strategic reasons. Development companies typically add employees and overhead during good times, and when hard times come, the revenue dries up and painful downsizing occurs. So my strategy was to keep overhead as low as possible and still build a team with top quality people. The answer, a one-man shop aligned with companies to deliver services on a project basis. property management, accounting, leasing, and the like. That freed my time to do what I like most, source and execute deals. So how does a Harvard man from Connecticut end up settling down in Raleigh? Lucky, I guess. The developer of the West Chase office buildings on Blue Ridge Road, Jim Baker, made recruiting trips to campus. His program sounded exciting. Learn the business of real estate ownership by leasing office space in Raleigh, then relocate to a market of my choice, and with his help and training, open a new office as a real estate entrepreneur. But the 1991 recession was very difficult for commercial and real estate nationwide, which changed the anticipated plan. I remain very grateful to Jim for introducing me to the Triangle. You've been through two major real estate recessions in 1991 and 2008. What lessons have you learned from those experiences? It's hard to see around the corner, and the travel time to most corners is about a year. So don't get too exposed to time frames you cannot see into and beyond. Trees do not grow to the sky. There will be good times and there will be a correction. We just don't know when. Timing is everything, and so is location. Keep some dollars in a coffee can at home. Do you ever have new college or MBA grads coming to you for advice? What do you tell them? I feel fortunate and flattered when young people ask me about the business. Notwithstanding the fact that free advice is worth what you pay for it, I encourage young people to think about not just chasing a career, but building a life. Make your calling your vocation. As a good friend of mine, Art Ross, says, your calling is when what you love to do intersects with what the world needs. You will be excited on Sunday nights to get started Monday morning, and take the rocking chair test often. Imagine yourself an older person looking back on your life at this moment. If you like what you see, keep doing it. If not, change, and find a way to weave a little kindness and empathy in your interactions with people. Relationships are precious. What's on your music playlist right now? The original soundtrack to the John Wayne movie, True Grit. Are you on Twitter or Facebook? And if not, why not? I am on neither. Life is for living. Online is missing life. What was the last movie you went to see at the movie theater? Frozen. I do have two young daughters. What's in your fridge right now? Everything organic, and some chocolate ice cream Heidi hasn't found yet, way in the back. And in the People on the Move section in the Triangle Business Journal, the People Spotlight is on Hans-Jörg Ill, President and CEO of Bühler Aeroglide. Equipped with formal training in mechanical manufacturing, Swiss national Hans-Jörg Ill has now been tapped as president and CEO of Bühler Aeroglide, a Kerry-based business unit within Bühler Group of Uzwil, Switzerland. Hans-Jörg Ill was previously based in Uzwil as head of the centralized logistics and automation departments at Bühler Group. He and his family are currently in the process of making the transition to North Carolina life as he begins his new role this week. Bühler Aeroglide is a manufacturer of custom-designed industrial conveyor dryers, ovens, roasters, toasters, and coolers. The company currently employs a total of 300 people, 250 of whom work at its Cary headquarters. What's one thing you wish people knew about your job? I want people to know how invested I am in this company. My family will be joining me soon. I am committed to helping Bühler Aeroglide continue to be successful and profitable business in North Carolina, for the people who work here as well as for the customers and industries it supports. Born and raised. I am from St. Gallen, Switzerland, which is situated in the northeast and close to the German border. It is named after an Irish monk. The Abbey Library of St. Gall is a famous landmark where books date back to the 5th century. What are your goals for this position? I will focus on the company's core strengths in sales, service, and innovation to increase profitability, improve company performance, and offer new solutions for customers. Bühler Group has a sales and service capability that includes over 12,000 people worldwide. My goal is to leverage this component of our business to enhance the customer experience and increase sales. Biggest pet peeve? My biggest pet peeve is indecisiveness. I appreciate people who are pragmatic and take responsibility for their decisions. Biggest worry? I am confident that the company will thrive and achieve new levels of success. Personally, I hope that my wife and son will find an easy transition into life in North Carolina. My wife is a psychologist and leads a successful practice where she is an experienced management coach. I also want my son to be comfortable and settled in a new school with friends. Triangle area business person you most admire? I am new to the Triangle and new to business in North Carolina. Therefore, I don't have a local business person to reference at this time. However, there are two globally recognized businessmen that I admire. Steve Jobs is one. The other is Richard Branson. Education. In Europe, students often specialize in their career interests early. I attended a Swiss apprenticeship program which provides schooling with practical training in mechanical manufacturing along with their direct access to the workplace. Personal. I am married to Barbara. I also have a 9-year-old son named Tobias. They will be joining me in June. And now we turn to the viewpoint page to the guest column. The guest column is headlined Community Foundation, 100 Years of Building Communities. And there are two writers. There's Lori O'Keefe, who is president of Triangle Community Foundation, and Jennifer Toll Whiteside, who is president and CEO of the North Carolina Community Foundation. At its core, America is philanthropic. When we see a problem, we join hands to fix it, contributing our money, time, and know-how. And we have more than a few urgent problems. Too many among us are hungry, homeless, unskilled, and unemployed. Too few kids graduate from high school. These problems defy simple answers, but anyone, however modest their means, can be part of creating solutions, thanks in large part to organizations launched in Cleveland 100 years ago. Known as community foundations, they are collectively a multi-billion-dollar engine for social good. Philanthropic hubs. The more than 700 U.S. community foundations are philanthropic hubs supporting and connecting donors and nonprofits. They make it easy for generous people to create charitable funds, and they manage the funds and work with donors to support causes they care about. Reflecting the deep generosity of Americans and their desire to help fix problems, U.S. community foundations steward more than $55 billion in assets, raise nearly $5 billion a year in new funds, and make annual grants totaling $4.2 billion. North Carolina is home to 12 nationally certified community foundations. Since the first community foundation was formed in North Carolina in 1919, these foundations have helped donors create more than 9,000 charitable funds totaling approximately $2.4 billion. And over that same period, they have awarded a total of nearly $2.6 billion in grants to address causes from hunger and homelessness to the arts and environment. Annually, their grant-making totals more than $236 million. The Triangle region of North Carolina is served by the Triangle Community Foundation and the North Carolina Community Foundation, both of which are accredited by the Community Foundation's National Standards Board. They both have their own focus that reflects local needs, the value of their assets, and the discretion donors have given them to make grants from their funds. Both have local philanthropy, collaboration, and partnership at their core. Perpetual philanthropy. Your community foundations provide a permanent home for philanthropic funds created by individuals, families, entrepreneurs, companies, and other organizations, and are a perpetual source of local philanthropic capital. With trillions of dollars expected to move between generations over the next 40 years, community foundations will play an indispensable role helping donors invest their dollars in local causes. As experts on philanthropy, local needs, and nonprofits, community foundations work with donors and their lawyers, accountants, and other professional advisors to create charitable funds to meet donors' family and business needs and reflect their personal values. They connect donors with nonprofits to advance their charitable interests, and they connect donors with one another so they can have a greater collective impact. Community resource. Community foundations are vital centers of knowledge for donors, nonprofits, businesses, government, and citizens. They raise awareness of philanthropy and local issues and bring together local leaders and experts to talk about possible solutions. They also help nonprofits manage their operating reserves and endowments and strengthen their organizations to better serve constituents. Whatever their focus, and whether they work in our biggest cities or smallest counties, community foundations are an important source of philanthropic expertise and capital. With our state facing pressing problems that elude quick fixes, our best hope of finding long-term solutions lies in the fundamentally American approach of working together to make our communities better. Through your community foundations, every North Carolinian can play a part in building our successful collective future. And with the moments that we have left, we'll read as much as we can of the 9 to 5 column. For the second consecutive year, Raleigh's Ashton Woods Homes has been named most trusted builder in America, according to a survey by Life Story Research of more than 40,000 new home buyers. To be named the most trusted builder 2 years in a row is a huge achievement and a testament to our customer-first philosophy, says Ken Ballow, president and CEO of Ashton Wood Homes. Raleigh-based commercial real estate firm NAI Carolantic has been named NAI Global Member of the Year, based on the firm's leadership, overall performance, and business growth. NAI Global is a global network of owner-operated commercial real estate brokerage firms. The awards were given last week at NAI's global convention in Las Vegas. NAI Carolantic took top honors for North America East. 5 senior living communities in the Raleigh-Durham area received Caring Star Excellence Awards based on consumer ratings and reviews. And we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.